Brethren, there's a reason the convention committee put Brother David Duran from Louisville, Kentucky, on as the last speaker this evening. Because this is the last service of the day, we don't have the pressure that we had earlier to stay on time. So I'm not going to come up here until Brother David Duran is finished. And if he goes past time, so much the better. His topic is Revelation Concepts. It's a pleasure to introduce Brother David Duran.
Good evening. That could be a recipe for disaster, couldn't it? I was thinking that Brother Lenny's discourse would have made the perfect conclusion for the evening. Very, very exciting. Your brethren in the Louisville Valeria send their love, and the brethren in northern Alabama also wish to have their love sent to you. They talk about L.A. with some frequency, but there it means lower Alabama. I want to thank publicly the Beniacs for being our hosts. They've made us more than comfortable. We've also enjoyed fellowship at the homes of the Nicoras and the Knapps. I would like to say that both of my topics were requested. I didn't even have to plan for this convention. I was told what I should do. Yeah, watch that. I do tend to have my voice drop off, I'm afraid. Revelation is an extremely spiritual book, and I'm not going to get into that tonight, which I greatly regret. But until we have some idea of how it's put together, what it attempts to do, it's much harder to get the spiritual lessons from it. And I am saying that because I know a lot of people are afraid of Revelation. I was. I was terrified of it. And what I would like to do this time in Monday is hopefully make you feel a little more comfortable with it. Obviously, it's complicated, but we'll try to simplify some of its concepts, although some things might not sound too terribly simple. You do have an outline in front of you, and I will be referring to it considerably. It has two sides, and the side which says approaching the apocalypse is the side which we will begin on and go through. We'll use the other side for reference later. Keys to understanding. Understanding how this great book is put together makes it much easier to figure out what it's doing. In one sense, it is extremely simple. It has three major parts. And then a little piece on the beginning and a little piece on the end. So if you want to picture it like a big three-hump camel with a head and a tail, that might help remember how it's put together. The architecture of the book is what is pictured on the other side of your handout. And you will notice there are there listed three major sections, plus a little beginning and a little ending. In essence, if you know the chart of the ages in your heads, you know the layout of the book of Revelation. It concentrates, obviously, on the gospel age and a little bit on the millennial age. So the three large sections are five views of the gospel age. Second section, five views of the harvest. Third section, five views of the millennial age. That's pretty easy, isn't it? There you are. I can go home now. It's the layout is very orderly, very simple. Five, five, five. Gospel age, harvest, millennial age. Now, within those, things get slightly more complicated, but look at what the five views happen to be. No. Yes, go right ahead. The first part, the Gospel Age, we have a view of seven churches, which covers the entire Gospel Age, seven periods of the Christian church. Then what happens is the Lord wants you to understand the age well, so he goes through it four more times. After we look at seven churches, we look at seven seals. We'll see why there's a difference in a little while. After you look at seven seals, you look at seven trumpets. But in each case, it simply doubles back and looks at the same period all over again from a different perspective. So you look at seven periods from one perspective, the same seven from another perspective, the same seven from a third perspective, and then you have two views left. Chapter 12, basically, which is about a woman, a dragon, and a false Michael. And chapter 13, which is about two beasts, an image, and the overcomer. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. Five views of the harvest period. That's the time we live. And in essence, what each of those views does is it starts at the beginning of the harvest and takes you to the destruction of Babylon. One extends a little bit beyond that. And then there are five views of the millennial age, not as obvious to the eye. And that's pretty much the entire story. We will get back and discuss some of those parts a little later. Next, under keys, I have listed Pastor Russell. I am sure that those of you who have studied the chapter on the time of the end in the volumes have realized that Brother Russell said the reason no one could figure out Daniel 11 is there was a historical key that had to happen before the understanding was possible. And that historical key was Napoleon Bonaparte. And until Napoleon came along and did what he did, Daniel was a locked up book. Well, there is also a key to Revelation. And that key is Charles Taze Russell. He, I believe, is the angel mentioned most particularly in chapter 17. Let me read verse 1. Chapter 17 is in that second section of Revelation, the part that talks about the harvest. And this particular angel that is mentioned here appears at this point in time, rather particularly, and follows us all the way through to the end of the book of Revelation. It says, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, as with the Apostle John. And John there, by the way, represents the church. Throughout Revelation, he represents the church in the flesh. So that's us. Anytime it's John, it's us. So this angel comes and speaks with John, saying, and I'm going to make a sound you can't put in there. He's saying, come here. And I'm doing that on purpose because he's a confidant. This angel introduced right here follows John all the way to the end of the book, and he keeps telling him secrets. He keeps telling him how to interpret the book. He keeps telling him what's happening. And if indeed you were to follow this angel from here to the end of the book, you would find out that the very things that he points out, point by point, are the things that Brother Russell taught. So that later in the book, it says, this angel is a man. I am sure, in my mind and in my heart, it is Charles Taze Russell. In this case, he says, come here, I'll show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. That is one of the things Brother Russell taught us. I will go so far as to say, you cannot interpret Revelation without believing who Brother Russell is in the plan of God. It is impossible. As a matter of fact, right here in this very complicated chapter 17, it makes a statement. Five are gone, one is yet to come. Now, how are you going to figure that out unless you know where you're standing in time? You have to be standing in time when this angel is right here next to you explaining things. It's in Brother Russell's day that five are gone. One is, and one is yet to come. If you don't recognize Brother Russell, you don't know where you are. When five are in the past, one is now, and one is yet to come. Brother Russell says, don't worship me. Now, I concur with that. But do recognize him. Brother Russell did not explain a great deal of Revelation. And frequently, when he did, he said, well, I think it's this way. He always kept making these statements like, somebody else will have to write the seventh volume, which for him was that code that meant, I don't know what Revelation's about. It's going to have to be told to you later. But the fact is, he did explain one chapter in the greatest of detail, and that's chapter 12. He did it in a reprint. He did it in one of the volumes. And when you study Revelation, I recommend that's where you start. Because this angel teaches you how to study the book because he interpreted one entire chapter for you, word by word. And you can work your way out from what he did teach to what he did not teach. All right, next on your outline, 20th century history. And this has to do with what we've just been saying. There probably has never been in the history of mankind a century more full of happenings, important happenings, than the century we have just come through. It would be perfectly absurd to think that the Bible just ignores it. I mean, the Bible gives pages and pages to time of the French Revolution. Why would it ignore the 20th century, which makes the French Revolution look like child's play? And much of the important material in the second section of Revelation has happened during the 20th century. It is documented then. Consequently, Brother Russell did not have those keys to help him interpret. We do. Even people who wrote on Revelation in the Bible student movement, like Brother Streeter, his books were what, 1920s on Revelation? They cannot possibly have the advantage of seeing what has happened in this century, which means enlightenment on these important chapters in the middle, the harvest chapters, were sort of mysterious to Brother Streeter because history was not there to demonstrate what they meant. We are not in that position. We are living at a time when we have the advantages of history to help us understand the things that are written. All right, more on that, a little bit more on that later. Next on your outline, church seal, trumpet, periods, and angels. I have suggested there a list of the dates of the churches, seals, and trumpets, and those that constitute the angels or messengers to them. It's a fairly standard list. I would say, if there is such a thing as a standard list amongst brethren who interpret Revelation, that's probably it. Brother Russell suggested those reformers as being those angels. I think he was correct. And, of course, once you understand who they are and know when they lived, the dates are sort of mandatory. And there are clues in Revelation to help nail them down. Next, we have a list of reasons and purposes for five views of the gospel age. Let me say at the outset that every time there is a series of seven churches, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven plagues, there's always introductory material to the series. Sometimes it's very big introductory material. For instance, chapters 4 and 5 are all an introduction to the seals that follow in chapters 6 and 7. So introductory material is dispersed always in front of these series. But let's look at them. Why have seven churches, seven seals, seven trumpets? The answer is sort of logical. First of all, when you read in chapters 2 and 3 about the seven periods of the church and church history, you will notice it's not addressed to us. It says, to the angel of the church in so-and-so, write these things. Those messages were specifically addressed to those who would be serving the church, to those angels, because they, in knowing that material, which is basically a list of strengths and weaknesses, will know how to counsel the church during their period to overcome those weaknesses. So the reason we have, first of all, a look at seven stages of the church is, it is a list of weaknesses and strengths that predominate at any given time. And if you're looking for an angel to help you overcome, because they all end to him that overcometh, you will look for someone who tells you how to overcome those particular weaknesses and to rely on those particular strengths. That's the purpose of the seven churches. The seven seals. You know what a seal is. It's something that locks something up. Or, if you open it, which is in the case of Revelation, it's something that reveals. Let me reason with you thusly. If you have an experience, do you understand it when you're going through it? No. If you do understand it in this lifetime, it is later when you look back upon it. And this is the concept of the seven seals. These same seven periods, the church goes through experiences, and when it has gone through them, those experiences are unsealed for understanding. In other words, at the end of Laodicea, we can look back and say, oh, that's what we've gone through. Consequently, a lot of the material under the seals tends to be material that you find historically at the end of the period rather than at its beginning. But the purpose of the seals is basically to show how historic events will affect the church. How historic events will affect the church. The trumpets, on the other hand, are there to show how truths will affect the world. It's the other way around. It's almost exactly the opposite. The angels who serve the seven churches are brought back for us, only this time they're blowing trumpets. Now, you know, and we'll talk about this on Monday, trumpets are rather a loud thing. That's why they use it with armies. They send signals like retreat and attack and what else ever they blow on their horns. Because you can hear trumpets over the din of battle. And this is precisely the point. The Lord is saying, I am sending out truth during these seven periods. I'm sending it out to the church, but it is so loud that the world will hear it and somewhat maybe even be affected by it. On the whole, they're going to try to ignore it. Which, by the way, is why later on you've got seven plagues. Because the Lord can say, during the age, you simply ignored my messages, even though you heard them. I'm going to force historic events on you that you can't ignore. Let's talk about that right now. At the bottom of that column, you see the trumpet plague connection? When you get a chance, the first number before the slash is the trumpet. The second number after the slash is the plague. There are seven of them. You will notice that they are all aimed at exactly the same thing. First trumpet, first plague on the earth. Second trumpet, second plague on the sea, all the way down through number seven. And the reason is, The trumpet didn't change the earth or the sea or the rivers and springs of water or the sun or create darkness or dry up the Euphrates or create hail. It failed to do that. And so the Lord says later, now at this end of the age, I'm going to throw those things at you, not as messages, but as historic catastrophes that you cannot ignore. All right, back up to reasons and purposes for 5 years of the gospel age. Chapter 12 is put there to show how apostate Christianity and the civil power will persecute the church. That's no surprise. You look back on history, you know what happened. Chapter 13 is showing how apostate Christianity would divide into factions. You start out with a 10-horned beast, and uh-oh, suddenly you got a 2-horned beast too. And then uh-oh, suddenly you've got an image of the beast. Things are multiplying. They are dividing into factions, and they will all oppose the truths promulgated by the true church. That's the point of chapter 13. And at that point, the Lord says, all right, I've showed you just about everything there is to know about the gospel age. That's hump number one on the camel. Your next thing on the outline, reasons and purposes for 5 views of the harvest. Very quickly. Chapter 14. You will find that sometimes this does not begin with first verse or end with last because the chapter divisions aren't always exact. But I'm just rounding off right now. Chapter 14 is showing the harvest work and its relationship to Babylon's fall. Every one of these, by the way, ends with Babylon being destroyed in a totally different picture. In chapter 14, at the end, you have Babylon being crushed like grapes. View number two, the 7 last plagues. This shows historic events which weaken the apostasy throughout the harvest. It also ends with Babylon's destruction. It says the city is divided and there was a great earthquake and great hail that weighed 100 pounds apiece. Can you imagine? I don't know how many of you. Do you have hail storms out here? Not much, huh? Well, back home we get hailstorms. Biggest I've ever seen was about like this. That makes your car look like, like it had smallpox. But these hailstones are going to be 100 pounds apiece. All right. Chapter 17 shows political events that are going to destroy Babylon. And that's an interesting story, too, because at the end of that chapter, where Babylon is this woman that has kept riding this beast, well, the beast turns around and eats the rider. Now, you can imagine, if you went out every Sunday morning for a horseback ride, you really enjoyed it for decades and centuries, and you get to the end of your ride one Sunday, and the animal turns around and eats you for dinner. That's the end of Babylon in chapter 17. Chapter 18 shows economic developments that will help Babylon fall. And then it shows, as chapter 19 opens, the subsequent rejoicing, which is the beautiful part of the picture. This is the only one that actually goes beyond Babylon's fall to saying, everybody said, oh, great, she's gone. Sometimes you think people are going to mourn over Babylon's collapse. That's not the story. Chapter 19, the first several verses, say, whoopee, she's had it. Good riddance. But chapter 18 ends with it being thrown like a millstone into the sea. So you see, we're seeing the same thing over and over again from a different perspective. But they're all the same picture, covering the harvest and how Babylon is weakened and finally destroyed. Chapter 19, starting verse 11, shows the spiritual view of the harvest period. At the end of that, it says, I saw the beast and the false prophet thrown alive into the lake of fire. 5 views of Babylon's destruction. You and I, brethren, have lived through a good percentage of the progress of those chapters. They are not over. Babylon's still around. But I would hate to be the object of those five gruesome destructions, and she will be. All right, we have already done the trumpet plague connection. We can skip that. Let's go to the next column, symbols. You know, I think, if you've looked at Revelation at all, that the very first verse says that Jesus signified it, or signified it, put it in signs and symbols, and sent it to John. It is a book of symbols. To take it literally is to ignore the first verse. Very frequently, even among us as Bible students, we tend to take some of it too literally. For instance, in chapter 12, which Brother Russell explained in great detail, we see Michael. And some brethren have said, well, Michael has always been the archangel. It's always been Jesus. It is in the book of Jude. It is in the book of Daniel. It must be here in the book of Revelation. Well, it's not. Because Revelation rarely means what it says. In this case, it's a counterfeit. Even God is not always God in the book of Revelation. 16:11, I think, is probably a good example of this, where we read, they blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and they did not repent. I think that's talking about the Pope. The God of heaven. Because heaven in Revelation is the symbol for the religious world. So don't jump to conclusions. Remember, almost anything you read in this book is likely to be a symbol. Now, here is an important point. Revelation attempts, upon a number of occasions, to interpret symbols for us. But it interprets symbols with other symbols. In other words, it will say, this equals this, but the this that it equals is another symbol. Please look with me in chapter 11, just as an example. Won't even try to understand the verse at this moment, but their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which mystically is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. Was Jesus crucified in Egypt? Was Jesus crucified in Sodom? These are all symbols. It's telling you Egypt equals Sodom. Where was Jesus crucified? In Jerusalem. But that's not even what's meant here. This is meaning Babylon, where he's crucified daily as part of the Mass. So in essence, we've got Babylon, the great city, Sodom, and Egypt, all equaling each other, all symbols, and Revelation's interpreting that. It's saying that Sodom, Egypt, Babylon equals in some respect. And yet there's not a literal statement there. 11:3-4. I will grant to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1260 days, clothed in sackcloth. They are the two olive trees and the two lampstands. Two witnesses, two olive trees, two lampstands. You know what that is, don't you? The Bible. It's the Old and New Testaments. Never calls it that, but it makes equivalence. Witnesses equal lampstands. Equal olive trees. Every one of them is a symbol, but it's interpreting a symbol as another symbol. Look at something more direct. Chapter 17. Let's look at verse 18. The woman whom you saw is, there's an equal sign, right? The woman is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Verse 15. The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. Clearly, Revelation's trying to interpret, but you notice the difficulty with which it interprets itself. It interprets a symbol with another thing. It is saying a woman is a city. And it doesn't tell you what it is. And then in verse 15, it tells you that what you saw in verse 1, that the woman happens to sit on waters, it tells you the waters are peoples, multitudes, and nations and tongues. Now that sounds pretty straightforward, doesn't it? Waters are peoples, nations, multitudes, and tongues. But if you study Revelation, you will find out that peoples, nations, multitudes, and tongues is not a literalism. It is a symbol for the C-class of humanity, as opposed to those who dwell on the earth, the established class of humanity. So even here, where it sounds like a fairly literal explanation, it's not. Makes things difficult, but keeps them interesting. Next on your outline, names. You find proper names throughout the book. Let me just take two, the Nicolaitans and John. A lot of people in interpreting Revelation try to find somebody named Nicholas and pin something on him. But Revelation uses names to represent characters or characteristics. You know, when we talk about God's name, we're talking about his character. Same here. Nicholas, the name means, the etymology of the name means one who lords it over another. And so when it is said in here that God hates the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, he's saying he hates it when brethren try to lord it over each other. That's the concept. Figuring out what the word means, what the name means from its etymology, will open up the prophecy. Likewise, John, which is a wonderful name. I never appreciated John as much as I do now. How many of you have that name, by the way? No Johns in the room? Just very few. What a pity. By the way, it has the H in it. Not just because it's a nice way to spell John. But it comes from a Hebrew word. A combination of two words. God's name, Yahweh. And a masculine form of Hannah. Hannah means grace. So John means the grace of Jehovah. Throughout the book, it represents us. Do you like that name? Because we are all miracles of grace. And throughout the book, every time it says, I, John, saw, it's saying, we who are miracles of grace from God, we saw. That's why we see, because we're miracles of grace from God. So the meaning of names is so intensely important. Never get a proper noun in Revelation without finding out where it came from and what it means. It will open up all kinds of doors. Next on that list of interpretive helps, and I saw. You cannot read Revelation without seeing constantly John using the term, and I saw, and I heard. It is a marker. We put chapters and verses in. They weren't there when John wrote them. But it is a marker. It always marks a new section. It will help us from making interpretive mistakes. Sometimes he will say two verses in a row. Sometimes he will go chapter and a half without using it. But the point is, it is always a marker. If he says, and I saw, he says, new perspective. Look at it from this side. And I heard, look at it from this side. Sometimes it takes you back 1,000 years. Sometimes it takes you forward 1,000 years. Sometimes it keeps you right where you are, but says, I want you to see it from another perspective. It is one of the most stable markers in the book of Revelation. And I saw. Never pass it up. Next little item, brethren. I mentioned this a little bit earlier about us. Brother Russell said somebody else had to write the seventh volume. I believe the brethren have done that. And I'm using it plural. I don't think any one of us understands the book of Revelation totally, individually. But I think we collectively do. And if we talk about it and put those collectivities together, we've got it. It's an open book. It is not a closed book at this end of the age. What I'm giving you this evening is something which I hope will take some of the fear out of the book. I don't tell you that everything I'm saying is right and that there isn't a better way to divide the book up, but you've got to start somewhere. And that's the point of tonight. If what I give you here you work with, you may say, I want to change it. Fine. But the point is, at least you've done something, and you know why you want to change it. So start somewhere. Dive in. It's a delicious piece of literature. All right, next, beasts and their parts. This always gets us, doesn't it? Let me go down, not at the beginning of where it says beasts, but that part that says in all of the above. Let's define beast. It is a large group of men, thus it can be an institution or a government, with unholy characteristics. That's all it is. It's a large group of people with unholy characteristics. Now, below that, I say their parts. Because Revelation always looks at the pieces on a beast. You know, if you look at an animal, it has parts. Now, Revelation doesn't mention them all, but it assumes that you're going to think about them all. You know, it talks about heads. What do you do with your head? Hopefully. Not this late at night, but if you're awake. You think. So heads represent philosophies. Thinking processes. It talks about horns. Now, too many of us are urban, but anybody who ever grew up in a rural society knows as long as the animal keeps his head up, you're okay. As soon as he puts it down and those horns are looking at you, you've got a problem with his exercise of power. And so the horn represents the power of this animal. Very logical. What Revelation never mentions but actually talks about is the body of the beast. That's people. Brother Russell makes that point in a very passing remark in one of the volumes, that the body of the beast is the people. Now, the head leads the people, and the horns on the head help us by their power to keep those leaders doing what they're doing. And the woman rides on it, meaning the Catholic Church has actually taken the reins and said, no, we're going this way, and we're going this way. But the body's always there. And in the end, and even in the French Revolution, it's the body that really creates the problem for the old order. Okay. Now, let's quickly go back up under beasts, chapters 12, 13, and 17. And I'm not going to keep you a whole lot longer, despite what Brother Carnegie said. In chapter 12, you got a dragon. Dragon represents civil power. In chapter 12, you have both a dragon and you have this character named Michael. And I mentioned that he's a forgery. He's a counterfeit. It's not Jesus. It's the papacy. And the whole point in chapter 12, because it's laid out to tell us certain things about history, is to show you how the papacy maneuvered the civil power of Rome to get it under its control. So that's why in chapter 12 you've got these two things. You've got Rome, civil power, shown as a dragon. and you've got this man-child, Michael, maneuvering to gain the power that Rome held. The result is what we normally call the Holy Roman Empire. So that's why you got those two characters there, to make that point. In the next chapter, chapter 13, you don't have to make that point. It's already made. So beasts there represent the combined power of that dragon plus Michael. The beast shows that Michael was successful. They did combine power. And church and state became one. Now, when you get to chapter 17, it's going to tell you how all this political maneuvering with religion is going to come to an end. So you need a different picture, and it has to be separated again. So the woman is separated, and she represents the apostate church. And she's not shown as part of the beast. She's shown as riding on the beast. And you know the reason, because it wants to show the beast going to eat her up. So the separation occurs there, and the beast does not include her anymore. She is simply a rider, not part of it. So the beast there is strictly civil power and the people under it. That's about as simple as I can make it. But if you struggle with it, that might be helpful. All right, one other point. The sixth anticipates the seventh. That'll be our closing. It actually looks like I got through the outline, but I'm skipping an awful lot of stuff. Historically, in the book of Revelation, Church number six, the Reformation Church, the Martin Luther period all the way up to Brother Russell, is the part that has the most pages devoted to it. You might think that's strange, because now seems the time that everything is happening. But for some reason, number six is really isolated as being big and important and covering all kinds of things. And the reason is, everything today had its beginnings then. In the sixth period of the church, Revelation says one-tenth of the city fell. That's when France had its revolution and Babylon fell apart in France. Obviously, we got nine-tenths of the city left. But the fact is, the beginnings occurred back under the sixth stage of the church. So, in many prophecies, you will find that the sixth events in the sixth stage anticipate the seventh. Let's take some of the things I have listed there. Chapter 6. I know you're sleepy. I am too. It's 11:30 my time. In chapter 6, verse 12, I looked. When he broke the sixth seal. This is the time of Martin Luther. And you notice the first thing it says, there was a great earthquake. It's the time of the French Revolution. And the world was afraid the French Revolution would spread. And you would have a worldwide time of trouble. It's too early for the time of trouble, isn't it? Among other things, the church wasn't finished. And that's precisely the point. Because as you go through the following description and ignore the chapter division, what happens when you get to chapter 7? You see four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds. In verse 2, another angel comes and says, don't harm the earth to sear the trees. And you could ask, why not? And the answer is given. Because I don't have 144,000 yet. You see how the time of trouble, in a sense, began at the time of the end, the French Revolution. But God said, don't let it spread. I need 144,000. Then in chapter 7, he takes the opportunity to tell you where they come from and that there's a great company and everything else. It's not that that has completion of it. It's saying, I can't let it spread until that is accomplished. That's why the seventh seal isn't mentioned until chapter 8. All right, look at 3:10. This is under the sixth church. Because you have kept the word of my perseverance, I also will keep you from the hour of testing, that hour which is about to come upon the whole world to test those who dwell upon the earth. That's spoken to the church before Brother Russell. And it says, I'm keeping you from the hour of temptation. The hour of temptation is now. It's the seventh period of the church. But it's referred to in a prophecy about the sixth. And I won't go through the rest of the list, because you can do that yourself. But just to make the point, very frequently you find the beginnings or references to our day under the sixth church seal or trumpet, where you don't expect to find it, because it had its beginning at that time. As a matter of fact, as we will see when we look at the trumpets on Monday, and you get to the third woe, it says, oh, it comes quickly. Don't fall asleep. Events from the sixth fold into the seventh so fast you don't have time to grab your breath. Now we need a good night's breath. May the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you very much, Brother Duran.
Our blessed and holy Father, we hallow thy name. We pray for your kingdom, mostly for what it will mean to thee and to thy Son, and then to us and to all of thy creation. We're grateful for this day, just packed with blessings. We ask your blessing in our hearts, that those things will lodge there which you would have us to learn and to practice. Please grant us the needed rest for the night, and help us to be prepared for the blessings of tomorrow. And where we displease thee, please forgive, and help us to work with one another to glorify thee and to edify the body of Christ, for we do ask it in his name.